B. Produce consciously and at will a corresponding responsiveness in the physical brain so that it can register accurately any information coming from the physical world and the emotional or astral world. C. Discriminate intelligently between all these spheres of sentient activity. This will all be eventually covered by a new psychological approach, which will emerge out of the old and be a blend of the mechanical schools, the introspective and the more purely oriental position, plus the conclusions of two new schools, which will shortly arise, but which are as yet too small to warrant a name. They are in the embryo stage. One school will deal with the energy aspects of the individual and his responsiveness to the energy of the universe in which he is immersed. The other will consider man as a unit of electricity. Both will be quite one-sided, but the contributions of the various schools will someday be unified into one synthetic presentation. Continued on side 10. Page 423. The second requirement which will establish relation between the working disciples in this group is the capacity to preserve a constant and sequential recollection of both the inner and the outer life. We call it continuity of consciousness, and by this we mean the power to be fully aware of all happenings in all spheres and departments of man's being during the entire 24 hours of the day. As yet, this is far from being the case. There is no real awareness of existence during the hours of sleep. The dream life, as related, is as full of illusion as any of the more definitely lower psychic experiences. The slowly growing interest in dreams from the standpoint of psychology and the investigation of their probable source are the first weak attempts towards establishing the awareness on a really scientific basis. There is as yet no conscious registering of mental activity during such times, for instance, as when the emotional body holds the center of the stage. With what is the mind occupied during a long period of emotional upset? It has, we know, its own life and its laws. Again, what are the activities of the soul when the personality is occupied exclusively with its own affairs? Is it impossible for you to vision a time when the development of consciousness will have reached the stage where there will be a sentient reaction in all the departments of man's nature and all of it recorded by the brain? Already men are aware both of physical plane activity and emotional aliveness simultaneously. That is, for the majority, a common and ordinary condition. Where two activities can be registered at once, why not three or even four? Such is the future ahead for the race, and the disciples, actively employed, will be the first to express and demonstrate this extended consciousness. Thus, telepathic interplay and extended sentiency must be developed and are also closely interlinked with each other. I have therefore pointed out the immediate future development of the individual disciple. What lies ahead in the immediate future for the group? First of all, a preliminary period of emergence into the public consciousness, and thus of making its presence felt. This will be done through the steady communication of the new ideals and the constant emphasis laid upon the essential oneness of all humanity. It will be the result of the uniformity and inclusiveness of the note sounded by one here and another there. During this stage, there must be no hurried work and no precipitate action of any kind. The growth of the group and of its ideas will be slow and sure. The group exists already. It has not to be formed and organized, and there is therefore, for none of you, the assuming of any sense of responsibility, nor the organizing of any activity designed to lure these disciples who have chosen thus to work subjectively into publicity. Such are not the methods approved by the elder brothers of the race, nor is it the way that they themselves work. Know each of you for yourselves whether you stand for the new position, the new attitude towards work, and for the subjective method. Decide once and for all whether you prefer to work in the old exoteric, ambitious manner, building and vitalizing an organization, and so producing all the mechanism which goes with such a method of work. Remember that such groups are still greatly needed and are useful. It is not yet the new age, and the little ones must not be left exposed to the new forces, nor turned out bereft of the nursery to which they naturally belong. Should the new mode of work appeal to you, see to it that the personality is subordinated, that the life of meditation is kept paramount in importance, that sensitivity to the subjective realm is cultivated, and any necessary outer activities are handled from within, outwards. Avoid a purely mystical introspection or its opposite extreme, an overemphasized organizing spirit, remembering that a life of truly occult meditation must inevitably produce outer happenings, but that these objective results are produced by an inner growth and not by an outer activity. An ancient scripture teaches this truth in the following terms. Quote, "When the sun progresses into the mansion of the serving man, the way of life takes the place of the way of work. Then the tree of life grows until its branches shelter all the sons of men. The building of the temple and the carrying of the stones cease. The growing trees are seen, the buildings disappear. Let the sun pass into its appointed place, and in this day and generation attend ye to the roots of growth." Close quote. Little groups will spring up here and there whose members respond to the new note and whose growth into the world group will be watched over by one or more working disciples. But these latter do not organize the groups. They grow as a man in this place and another in that place awakens to the new vision or comes into incarnation in order to take his place in the work and bring in the new era. These groups will demonstrate no sense of separateness. They will be unaware of personal or of group ambition. They will recognize their unity with all that exists and will stand before the world as examples of pure living, constructive building, creative activities subordinated to the general purpose, beauty, and inclusiveness. Perhaps in the early stages of integration, the words friendliness and cooperativeness best describe them. They are not interested in dogmas or doctrines and have no shibboleths. Their outstanding characteristic will be an individual and group freedom from a critical spirit. This non-criticism will not grow out of an inability to see error or failure to measure up to an idea. Falsity, impurity, and weakness will be recognized for what they are, but when noted, will only serve to evoke a loving helpfulness. Little by little, these groups will come to know each other and to meet with one another at set times and places. They will come to these mutual conferences with no desire to impress one another and with no thought of relative numerical strength. They will demonstrate no ambition to increase their ranks. How should they when they know themselves all to be members of the one world group? They have no teaching to give of a doctrinal nature and will not seek to demonstrate learning. They will meet solely to discuss modes of world helpfulness, the formation of a platform so universal and composed of such basic truths that it can be presented under all the varying methods and utilize the many terminologies. They will endeavor to employ each other's terms and to familiarize themselves with each other's approach to reality and symbology. Little by little also, the special contribution and note of each group will be recognized, and where a need exists for just that special approach and the particular note or method of interpretation in any part of the world, there will be an immediate and united impulse to facilitate the work that that special group could do in that place. These groups, with the one subjective group of conscious living souls behind them, will be too busy with world service and interests to waste time on trifling non-essentials. They will not have the time to play around with group names and insignia and badges and the technicalities of fraternities when they meet together. World needs, world opportunities, and the rapid development of the consciousness of mankind and the initiation of humanity into the spiritual realities will so engross their attention that they will have no interest in purely physical plane arrangements, nor in laying the emphasis upon their own personal growth. They will be well aware that response to world need in service and the life of focused meditation will promote their growth. Their eyes are not upon themselves, upon their own good characters, or upon their individual accomplishments. Later, as a result of their telepathic relationship and their united conferences, there may emerge certain esoteric groups and schools for development in order more rapidly to equip them for world service. In these schools, modes of meditation, the intensification of vibration, and the laws of the universe will be taught, and the right use of color and of sound. But all will be subordinated to the idea of service and the uplift of humanity. Also, the schools referred to in Letters on Occult Meditation will gradually come into being. But what use is it for me to forecast the future in more explicit terms and hold out a picture of an intriguing quality when at the present time the integration of the group of world mystics and its close welding is not an accomplished fact? World unity, brotherhood in its true sense, the growth of telepathic interplay, the elimination of the non-essentials which serve to separate the thoughts of men and bring about separateness on the physical plane, and the laying of a true emphasis upon the fundamentals of the ageless wisdom, the manifestation of a true understanding, the bringing about of at-one-ment with the soul, the recognition of those who belong to the group of world saviors, this is the immediate work to be done, and this must engross your attention. This and this alone warrants the expenditure of all that any of you have to give, love and life, time and money. This and this alone justifies your existence and calls forth from all of you who respond to the vision that utter self-sacrifice which is so rare and so far-reaching in its effects. The casting of all that one has at the feet of the Lord of Life, in order that the work of world salvage may go forward, the elimination out of one's life of all that can possibly hinder, the giving of all that one has until it hurts to give, the ruling of one's life on the basis of surrender, asking oneself all the time, what can I relinquish in order that I may help more adequately, that and more than that lies ahead of all of you who hear the call and respond to the need and opportunity. Let me tell you this. This group, now in process of forming, will in time develop its own yoga and school of training, which will gradually supersede that of the Raja Yoga and Bhakti Yoga schools. The method of training will only be given to those who have trained the mind and learned to control the emotions, hence the key to what is now going on. The mode of training will be no easy shortcut to the goal. Only the intelligent can attain it, and only coordinated personalities will be eligible to the teaching. The keynote of the new yoga will be synthesis. Its objective will be conscious development of the intuitive faculty. This development will fall into two categories. First, the development of the intuition and of true spiritual perception, and secondly, the trained utilization of the mind as an interpreting agent. In the book Agni Yoga, some of the teaching to be given has filtered through, but only from the angle of the will aspect. No book has as yet made its appearance which gives in any form whatsoever the yoga of synthesis. We have had Bhakti Yoga, or union through devotion. Raja Yoga is now receiving emphasis, which is union through the mind. It sounds like a redundancy to speak of union through synthesis, but it is not so. It is union through identification with the whole, not union through realization or through vision. Mark well this distinction, for it holds the secret of the next step for the personalities of the race. The Bhagavad Gita gives us primarily the key to the yoga of devotion. Patanjali teaches us the yoga of the mind. In the gospel story, we have the portrayal of realization, but the key or the secret of identification is still withheld. It lies in the custody of a few in this integrating group of mystics and knowers, and will be wrought out into manifestation in the furnace of their individual experience and thus given to the world. But the time is not yet. The group must grow in strength and knowledge and in intuitive perception. You ask me, what keeps a man from becoming a member of such a group? I tell you with emphasis that four things only keep a man from affiliation. First, an uncoordinated personality. This involves necessarily an untrained mind and a feeble intellect. Second, a sense of separateness, of distinction, and of being set apart or different from one's fellow men. Third, the possession of a creed. No matter how good a formula of beliefs it may be, it inevitably produces exclusiveness. It bars some out. Fourth, pride and ambition. You ask again, how shall one qualify? The rules are simple and are three in number. First, learn to practice harmlessness. Then, desire nothing for the separated self. And thirdly, look for the sign of divinity in all. Three simple rules, but very hard to accomplish. Behind this group of mystics, which includes thinkers in every department of human thought, let me reiterate the word thinkers, and of human knowledge stands the hierarchy of masters, and in between these two groups stand also a band of teachers, of whom I am one. These act as intermediaries and as transmitters of energy. May I repeat and beg you to attend that this group which is slowly forming is gathered out of every imaginable group of thinking and intelligent men. As yet, and this may surprise a few, there are not very many occultists, so-called, among them. This is due to the fact that the occultists are numerically few in relation to the masses of humanity, and also to their tendency to be sectarian, exclusive, and self-righteous. Selfless humanitarian workers are there. Political leaders and economists and scientific workers in the world's laboratories are also there. Churchmen and religious adherents from all the world religions are there, and the practical mystics and a few occultists. The true occultist is rare. The group is and will be kept entirely subjective. Its members are linked telepathically, or they recognize each other through the quality of the work they are doing in the outer world and the inclusiveness of the note they sound. It is inspired from above by the souls of its members and the great ones, and is energized into activity by the need of humanity itself. It is composed of living, conscious souls working through coordinated personalities. Its symbol is a golden triangle enclosing an even-armed cross with one diamond at the apex of the triangle. This symbol is never reproduced in form at all. It shines above the heads of all who are in the group and cannot be seen by anyone, not even a clairvoyant, except a group member, and then only if, for purposes of work, his recognition needs stimulation. The motto of the group is the glory of the one. More I may not tell you now, but this will give you some idea of the reality of the work that is going on. It may serve as an incentive to fresh effort on the part of all working to equip themselves for selfless service. We are to take up now a very brief consideration of two types of energy of a major kind, which are in themselves composed and blended of coordinating energies. The subject matter is therefore of so advanced a nature that it is useless for the aspirant to give much time to its study. Volumes would be necessitated, likewise, if all that could be said were written, and it will only be possible in this book to outline some broad generalizations and to indicate certain facts of interest. The main reason that it profits us not to study these energies too closely is because the planetary spirit, or logos, and the planetary entity are the two forms in active manifestation which respond most forcibly to the impact of these energies. The human being responds, and that only subconsciously, because, in his form nature, he constitutes part of the planetary expression. The planetary spirit is a being who, ages ago, passed through the state of consciousness which we call the human state and has left it far behind. He, using the personal pronoun simply for the sake of terminological clarity, has an origin which lies outside the solar system altogether. His life is focused in the planet. His consciousness lies in realms beyond the concept of the highest adept in our planetary hierarchy. The planetary entity is the sum total of the forms which constitute the form through which the planetary spirit is manifesting, and therefore is the synthesis of the planetary physical, astral, and mental elementals. For the purposes of our consideration, this entity is the sum total of all physical, vital, astral, and mental forms which, blended and fused, constitute our planet. Each is the embodiment of energy, and these two major streams which produce the form and the consciousness aspects of our planetary existence make their impact on the human being. The life of the planetary spirit makes its impact via the soul, and the life of the planetary entity is registered through the medium of the personality mechanism. The quality of these energies is primarily astral Buddhic, and the bias of the life forces and the general trend of the impulses influencing humanity in this great cycle are the attractive energy of the intuitional nature of the planetary logos and the potent force of the astral desire body. In other words, the astral elemental, which embodies the desire nature of the planetary logos, is exceedingly potent, particularly in this present cycle. But the strength of the spiritual and intuitional nature of the one in whom we live and move and have our being is steadily increasing. On the one hand, you have the devastating expression of the wild hunt for pleasure, of sex, and of the crime incident to the satisfying of desire. This characterizes our present civilization and is now at its height. It may be said that it is even on the decline, little as you may sense it. At the same time, there is found the open door of initiation. Both these opportunities, if I might so term them, are found simultaneously present, but the strength of the one is weakening and the trend towards the other is growing. Thus the way out can be seen. In the above paragraph, the dominant planetary urges present in evolution are summed up and man's reaction to them noted. Solar energies have also a dual effect. First, there is what we might call the pranic effect, which is the result of the impact of solar force emanating from the physical sun. This produces definite results upon the objective forms, and these are termed physical or vital. These enter the human body via the spleen and also via a center found between the shoulder blades. This center is between the throat center and the heart center in the spinal column, but nearer the heart than the throat. Secondly, there are energies which emanate from what is esoterically called the heart of the sun. These sweep through one or other of the planets in seven great streams and pour into the soul of man and produce that sensitivity which we call awareness. These seven types of energy produce the seven types of souls or rays, and in this thought you find the secret of soul unity. During manifestation, owing to the seven types of energy impacts playing upon the matter of space, one finds the seven types of souls, the seven fields of expression, and the seven grades of consciousness and of ray characteristics. These differentiations, as you well know, are like the coloring that the prism takes when subjected to the rays of the sun, or to the tracery of pattern found in reflection upon a limpid pool. Astrology and the energies. To these two energies, a third group of energies must be added, and these are the basis of much of our astrological research. They emanate from the 12 constellations which form our solar zodiac. Their effect is infinite, and the permutations of these three groups of energies lead to the infinite complication which we find in nature. The claims of the astrologers as to the reality of the energies playing upon the human organism can be seen to be true. Their claims as to their capacity to interpret are, for the most part, unfounded. So little is really known by the highest intelligence on the planet, for forget not that the adepts utilize primarily the intuition. These energies leave their mark upon every form in every kingdom in nature, acting as a retrograding or a stimulating force. They carry one type of energy onto a fuller expression of the quality of any form, or hold another back from a developed manifestation. It is not opportune here to outline the nature of true astrology. That astrology is a science and a coming science is true. That astrology in its highest aspect and its true interpretation will enable man eventually to focus his understanding and to function rightly is equally true. That in the revelations that astrology will make in time to come will be found the secret of the true coordination between soul and form is also correct. But that astrology is not yet to be found. Too much is overlooked and too little known to make astrology the exact science that many claim it is. The claim will be fulfilled at some future date, but the time is not yet. Certain factors which astrologers should bear in mind, and certain conditions they are only too apt to forget, may, however, be briefly noted. For the sake of clear understanding, we will simply tabulate a number of statements which should be studied with care by the average investigator in this field. I cannot here write a treatise on the energies with which astrology should deal, sorely as such a treatise is needed. Astrologers concern themselves primarily with three types of energy. A. The energy of the constellation in which the sun is posited at the time of birth. B. The rising sign to which the man should respond. C. The moon which governs his form aspect and particularly the physical form. The energy of the particular constellation or sign in which a man is born is more deeply significant than has ever yet been suggested. It embodies or indicates his present problem, sets the pace or tempo of his life, and is related to the quality of his personality. It governs, if I may so express it, the rajasic or activity aspect of his life during incarnation. The ascendant or rising sign indicates the line along which his energy as a whole can flow if he is to fulfill the purpose of any incarnation. This, of course, if rightly handled. It holds the secret of his future, and in its symbolism and understanding, he can find the clue to his life problem and an indication of what he can be and achieve. It presents to him the type of force which will enable him to succeed. This, when duly consummated, might be regarded as producing the sattvic, or harmony aspect of his life, for when it plays its part and is utilized, it produces harmony with the will of the soul during any particular incarnation. In the moon influence, we have indicated the native's past. It summarizes the limitations and handicaps under which he must work, and therefore might be regarded as embodying the tamasic aspect of matter, or that which holds back, and which, if permitted to influence unduly, will produce inertia. In the body with which man is equipped lies hid the secret of past experience, and every lunar form through which we have to arrive at due expression is in itself the product or synthesis of all the past. Let me see if I can put the present truth about astrology in such simple guise that they who know naught of this intricate science may understand. The birth month indicates the day of opportunity. The door stands open. The particular month in which a soul comes into incarnation is indicated to that soul by the month in which it passed out of incarnation in a previous life cycle. If it, for instance, died in the month governed by the sign Leo, it will return into incarnation in the same sign, picking up the thread of experience where it left it, and starting with the same type of energy and the peculiar equipment with which it passed away from Earth life, plus the gain of thought and conscious onlooking. The quality of the energy and the nature of the forces to be manipulated during life are indicated to the soul in this way. The rising sign, embodying another type of energy, should wax in strength during the incarnation, for it indicates the nature of the soul force that the incarnated Son of God is seeking to wield through the medium of a particular personality possessing certain characteristics. The influence of the moon is primarily physical. The prison of the soul is thus indicated. The handicaps to be met are thus secured. The type of body or of bodies through which the force of the native sign and the quality of the energy which will bring him to his goal are thus defined. Through the medium of the lunar lords and what they have given him as the result of past experience down the ages, must he express himself upon the physical plane. Owing to the precession of the equinoxes, a situation is brought about in which a fourth type of force makes itself felt. The sun is, in reality, many degrees away in the great round of the heavens from where it is stated to be, as far as the greater zodiac is concerned. This is, of course, from the standpoint of time. As the sweep of the sun through a constellation covers a period of approximately 2,200 years, the shift in the course of the centuries is very slight. So slight that little difference would be noted in the casting of the planetary horoscope. In the casting of the horoscope of a solar system, it would be of vital importance, but this is so far beyond the capacity of the wisest astrologer on our planet that discussion is immaterial. In casting the horoscope of a human being who is born in a particular month, however, it should be borne in mind, which it seldom is, that now the month and the sign do not coincide at all. The sun is really not in Leo, for instance, during the month of August. The correct interpretation, therefore, of a chart is largely psychometrical and dependent upon the thought form of the constellation which has been built up for ages by the astrologers. Energy follows thought. For thousands of years, certain types of energy and their consequent qualifying effects on substance and form have been considered to be thus and so. Therefore, thus they are, except in the case of the highly evolved, of the true aspirant who has oriented himself and is thus escaping from the wheel of existence and beginning to govern his stars, and so is no longer under their rule and domination. Astrology now deals primarily with the personality for whom the horoscope may be cast and with the events of the personality life. When, through meditation and service, plus the discipline of the lunar bodies, a man comes consciously and definitely under his soul ray, then he comes as definitely under the influence of one or other of the seven solar systems as they focus their energy through one or other of the constellations and subsequently one or other of the seven sacred planets. Eventually, there will be 12 sacred planets corresponding to the 12 constellations, but the time is not yet. Our solar system, as you know, is one of seven. When a man has arrived at this point in evolution, birth months, mundane astrology, and the influences which play upon the form aspect become of less and less importance. This circle of solar systems affects paramountly the soul, and it becomes a focal point of spiritual energies. This is the problem of the soul on its own plane. Responsiveness to these types of energy, and of them the personality, is totally unaware. The signs, which fall therefore into the four categories of earth, water, fire, and air, concern primarily the man who lives below the diaphragm and who utilizes the lower four centers, the center at the base of the spine, the sacrocenter, the solar plexus, and the spleen. The inner group of seven major or systemic energies produce their effect upon the man who is living above the diaphragm and work through the seven representative centers in the head. Four of them focus through the throat center, the heart center, the ajna, and head centers. Three are held latent in the region of the head centers, the thousand-petal lotus, and only enter into functioning activity after the third initiation. It will be evident, therefore, how complicated from the standpoint of the horoscope, as well as of the individual problem, is this meeting of the energies of two types of constellations in the case of the man who is neither purely human nor purely spiritual. The ordinary horoscope is negated. The horoscope is not possible as yet of delineation. The only horoscope which is basically and almost infallibly correct is that of the entirely low-grade human being who lives entirely below the diaphragm and is governed by his animal nature alone. Astrologers must remember also that there are several undiscovered planets which are producing pulls and shifts and focusing streams of energy upon our Earth which tend to complicate the problem still further. Pluto is one of them, and having now emerged into manifestation, or rather into recognition, to it will be assigned all the unexplained conditions. Pluto will be made the scapegoat for faulty astrology for a long time to come. This chart failed to work and be true because Pluto must be influential in it and we know little about Pluto. So the story will run. Yet Pluto has always been revolving around our sun and producing its effects. It governs, however, the death or cessation of old ideas and emotions, and its influence is therefore largely cerebral, and in that you have the clue to its late discovery. Mankind is only on the verge of becoming mental. Its effects are felt first in the mental body. The names of the planets are not the result of arbitrary choice, but the planets name themselves. Astrologers will eventually find it necessary to cast three horoscopes or three charts, one purely physical, dealing with the body of nature, one primarily emotional and dealing with the quality of the personality and with its sensitivity or state of awareness. The third will be the chart of the mental impulses and conditions. It will be found that these three charts will take certain geometrical lines. The lines of energy will form patterns. These three charts, superimposed one upon the other, will give the personality diagram, the individual life pattern. Amazing symbolic charts and lineal forms will be found to emerge when this is done, and the geometry of the individual will grow out of this, for it will be found that each line will function in relation to another line, and the trends of the life energies will become apparent. Eventually, even in this department of knowledge, the star will shine forth. This will constitute a new branch of psychology, and its true exponent for our age will duly be found. I but indicate the lines of the future astrology in order to safeguard the present. One thing astrologers need at this time to do, and that is to make due allowance for this transition period out of Pisces into Aquarius. This is seldom done, but it is evident that the tremendous turmoil incident to these transitions affects the individual chart and frequently offsets individual destiny or karma. People are submerged in planetary and racial destinies, and their own tiny affairs are offset almost entirely and sometimes completely negated. It is not possible to cast the horoscope of the planet, and those who propose to do so are deceiving themselves and others. The horoscope of the fourth kingdom in nature, of humanity, will eventually be cast, but it will be done by initiates, and there are no initiate astrologers working on the physical plane at this time. One hint here I give. The sun was in Sagittarius when the first human tendencies struggled to the fore. The stage of animal man was completed, and when Sagittarius was dominant, from our planetary standpoint, I am using words with care, the great event of individualization took place. But the brain of the then human being failed to register what had happened. In the words of the old commentary, quote, "The sons of God shot forth like arrows from the bow. The forms received the impulse, and lo, a god was born. The tiny babe knew not the great event." Close quote. This took place 21 million years ago. Cycles passed, and when at a later date the sun was in Leo, approximately 18 million years ago, the first instances of coordination between brain and mind took place, and the human being was definitely self-conscious. He registered his individuality. The figures for the first date, though exactness is not possible in a system of mutation such as ours, are 21,688,345 years ago. These figures are useless at this time, for they can neither be proved correct nor incorrect. Later investigation will prove their usefulness when the nature of time is better understood. Sagittarius governs human evolution, for it symbolizes progress towards a conscious goal. Leo governs the human consciousness in the human kingdom, for the energy pouring through it enables man to say, "I am." It might be of value if I here attempted a translation, necessarily inadequate, of the key word of each sign. These fall into two categories as far as humanity is concerned. There is the key word for the form aspect and the key word for the soul aspect. In the first case, the word is expressed. In the second, it is consciously spoken by the soul. Translated into modern terms, much is lost, but the underlying thought which directs the work of the emanating energies is of value. For our world period, they are as follows. For the aspirant who progresses from Aries to Pisces and has therefore reoriented himself, we have Aries, I come forth, and from the plane of mind, I rule. Taurus, I see, and when the eye is opened, all is illumined. Gemini, I recognize my other self, and in the waning of that self, I grow and glow. Cancer, I build a lighted house, and therein dwell. Leo, I am that, and that am I. Virgo, I am the mother and the child. I, God, I, matter, am. Libra, I choose the way that leads between the two great lines of force. Scorpio, warrior I am, and from the battle I emerge triumphant. Sagittarius, I see the goal, I reach the goal and see another. Capricorn, lost am I in light supernal, and on that light I turn my back. Aquarius, water of life am I, poured forth for thirsty men. Pisces, I leave the Father's home, and turning back, I save. From the standpoint of the form, the life proceeds in a reverse direction, and the work of nature is seen under the following words. Pisces, and the word said, go forth into matter. Aquarius, and the word said, let desire in form be ruler. Capricorn, and the word said, let ambition rule and the door stand wide. Sagittarius, and the word said, let food be sought. Scorpio, and the word said, let Maya flourish and deception rule. Libra, and the word said, let choice be made. Virgo, and the word said, let matter reign. Leo, and the word said, let other forms exist, I rule. Cancer, and the word said, let isolation be the rule, and yet the crowd exists. Gemini, and the word said, let instability do its work. Taurus, And the word said, let struggle be undismayed. Aries, and the word said, let form again be sought. It will be noted that all these ideas concern the work of energy in some form or another, and in the last grouping, with the work of the so-called unregenerate, selfish individual, full of desire for satisfaction. The group of mantric words used by the aspirant in the power of his own soul are positive. It seems needless to deal further with the various types of force, and we shall now turn our attention to Rule 11. Rule 11. Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Next, pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. And finally, utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. Analysis of the three sentences. Salvation from our thought forms. Salvation from death. Rule 11. Analysis of the three sentences. This rule is, as you know, the last of those governing work on the astral plane and the magical task of motivating those thought forms which are to be the expression of some type of energy. We have considered the various energies with which men work and the power a man can wield through building thought forms. We have seen also how a man can manipulate the various grades of matter until the embodied idea has clothed itself with mental matter and with astral matter. It is therefore a vital entity on the verge of materializing upon the physical plane. Nothing, it should be noted, can now stop its emergence into objectivity except the expressed act of the will of its creator, for the form, being vitalized by that creator, is subject always to his will until he has severed his connection with it by the utterance of the mystic phrase. We will assume that emergence into effective existence is the decision and that the creative work is carried forward. It will here be noted that this work is either conscious or unconscious. In the unconscious building of thought forms, such as is the case with the average human being, many never produce the desired physical plane effects and fail in their intended purpose. As long, however, as man is animated by selfishness and by hatred, this is a beneficent thing. Fortunately for the human race, few people as yet work in mental matter. Most of them work with astral or desire matter, and these forms are fluidic and changeable and are powerful only through the faculty of persistence. There is an occult basis for the statement that if one desires a thing for a sufficiently long period of time, one will possess it. Such is the law governing the return to incarnation of the average human being. Lacking the one-pointedness of the mental plane matter, as it is influenced by a concentrated mind, these desire forms fail to do the damage they otherwise might. Their effect is felt largely by the creator of these kama-manasic forms and not by his environing associates. The moment that the mind factor enters in and becomes dominant, that moment a man becomes dangerous or useful, as the case may be. Dangerous not only to himself, but to those around him, or useful in the working out of the plan of evolution. He can then create thought forms capable of producing outward manifesting results and tangible effects. Given aspiration, however, and spiritual impulse, a man can become a true occultist and produce organized results and functioning organisms upon the physical plane. I use the word organism deliberately, for it will serve to convey the idea that any thought form is regarded by us as a subjective and existing entity, clothed in subtle matter and capable of manifestation. This is called popularly sometimes the working out of an idea, or the carrying through of a project. It is termed at other times a discovery, or an invention, or something of that nature. All the time, quite unrealizing it, man is talking in occult terms and evidencing an inner appreciation of the methods whereby all that has been thought, by God or man, comes into existence. The embodied idea or thought, the former being potentially far more potent than the latter, has worked its way through to the verge of physical manifestation. Who, in the case of a white magician, is not an emotionally centered person, is consciously bringing it to the stage when its inner purpose and plan can be demonstrated. He holds the thought form in his consciousness and gives it shape and energy through the power of his own one-pointed mental focus. We are told in the rule under consideration that the aspirant has three things to do. 1. Ascertain the formula which will crystallize the form he has built, much in the same way that we find architects and bridge builders reducing the desired form to a mathematical formula. 2. Pronounce certain words which will give the form vitality and so carry it forth onto the physical plane. 3. Utter the phrase which will detach the thought form from his aura and so save the drain upon his energies. It will be noted that the formula has relation to the thought form, the words of power to the objective for which the form has been constructed, and the mystic phrase concerns the severing of the magnetic link which binds together the creator and his creation. One therefore concerns the form, another the soul embodied in the form, whose lowest characteristic is desire, the reflection of love, and the last, the life aspect with which the Creator has endowed the creation. We are consequently face to face again with the eternal triplicities of spirit, soul, and body. It should be remembered that the rules for magic, as understood by the true esotericist, are as true of a created universe, solar system, or planet, as they are true of the tiny thought creations of a chela or aspirant. The first reaction of the average student on reading the above is to think immediately of the body nature as it expresses some type of energy. Thus, duality is the thing noted, and that which employs the thing is present in his mind. Yet one of the main necessities before occult aspirants at this time is to endeavor to think in terms of the one reality, which is energy itself and nothing else. Therefore, it is of value to emphasize in our discussions of this abstruse subject the fact that spirit and energy are synonymous terms and are interchangeable. Only in the realization of this can we arrive at the reconciliation of science and religion and at a true understanding of the world of active phenomena by which we are surrounded and in which we move. The terms organic and inorganic are largely responsible for much of the confusion and the sharp differentiation existing in the minds of many people between body and spirit, between life and form, have led to a refusal to admit the essential identity and nature of these two. The world in which we live is regarded by the majority as really solid and tangible, yet possessing some mysterious power lying concealed within it which produces movement, activity, and change. This is, of course, putting it crudely, but it suffices to sum up the unintelligent attitude. The orthodox scientist is largely occupied with structures, relationships, with the composition of form, and with the activity produced by the component form parts and their interrelations and dependencies. The chemicals and elements and the functions and parts they play, and their mutual interactions as they compose all forms in all the kingdoms of nature, are the subject of their investigation. The nature of the atom, of the molecule and the cell, their functions, the qualities of their force manifestations and the varying types of activity, the solving of the problem as to the character and nature of the energies, focalized or localized in the differing forms of the natural or material world, demand the consideration of the ablest minds in the world of thought. Yet the questions, what is life, what is energy, or what is the process of becoming and the nature of being, remain unanswered. The problem as to the why and the wherefore is regarded as fruitless and speculative, almost insoluble. Nevertheless, to the pure reason and through the correct functioning of the intuition, these problems can be solved and these questions answered. Their solution is one of the ordinary revelations and attainments of initiation. The only true biologists are the initiates of the mysteries, for they have an understanding of life and its purpose, and are so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects, and all their activities in connection with the work of the planetary hierarchy are based on a few fundamental formulas which concern life as it makes itself felt through its three differentiations or aspects: energy, force, matter. It should be noted here that only as a man understands himself can he arrive at an understanding of that which is the sum total that we call God. This is a truism and an occult platitude, but when acted upon, leads to a revelation which makes the present unknown God a recognized reality. Let me illustrate. Man knows himself to be a living being and calls death that mysterious process wherein that something which he commonly designates as the breath of life is withdrawn. On its withdrawal, the form disintegrates. The cohesive vitalizing force is gone, and this produces that falling apart into its essential elements of that which has hitherto been regarded as the body. This life principle, this basic essential of being, and this mysterious elusive factor is the correspondence in man of that which we call spirit or life in the macrocosm. Just as the life in man holds together, animates, vitalizes, and drives into activity the form, and so makes of him a living being, so the life of God, as the Christian calls it, performs the same purpose in the universe, and produces that coherent, living, vital ensemble which we call a solar system. This life principle in man manifests in a triple manner. One, as the directional will, purpose, basic incentive. This is the dynamic energy which sets the being functioning, brings him into existence, sets the term of his life, carries him through the years, long or short, and abstracts itself at the close of his life cycle. This is the spirit in man, manifesting as the will to live, to be, to act, to pursue, to evolve. In its lowest aspect, this works through the mental body or nature, and in connection with the dense physical, makes itself felt through the brain. 2. As the coherent force. It is that significant essential quality which makes each man different, which produces that complex manifestation of moods, desires, qualities, complexes, inhibitions, feelings, and characteristics which produce a man's peculiar psychology. This is the result of the interplay between the spirit or energy aspect and the matter or body nature. This is the distinctive subjective man, his coloring or individual note. This it is which sets the rate of vibratory activity of his body, produces his particular type of form, is responsible for the condition and nature of his organs, his glands, and his outer aspect. This is the soul, and in its lowest aspect, it works through the emotional or astral nature, and in connection with the dense physical, through the heart. 3. As the activity of the atoms and cells of which the physical body is composed. It is the sum total of those little lives of which the human organs, comprising the entire man, are composed. These have a life of their own, and a consciousness which is strictly individual and identified. This aspect of the life principle works through the etheric or vital body, and in connection with the solid mechanism of the tangible form, through the spleen. It is not, of course, possible to give the mantric words and phrases which I mentioned in Rule 11. They would be profoundly incomprehensible to all but the initiate, and therefore need not engross our attention. It should be noted that much in these instructions is in advance of modern thought, and both these instructions and the treatise on cosmic fire will only be fully understood towards the end of this century. Let us consider this rule sentence by sentence, and arrive at that one of the interpretations which is the easiest for the average aspirant. All these rules can be read from the standpoint of intelligent man and will mean but little. They can be read from the standpoint of the aspirant and will then convey certain practical ideas which are susceptible of daily application and can be wrought out in the crucible of life experience. They will achieve meaning as the aspirant learns to handle energies, to work in mental matter, and to cooperate creatively with the purpose underlying the evolutionary plan. From the angle of vision of the disciple, these rules carry certain potent instructions and will lead him to an understanding of the process of the creative work in nature, which is necessarily sealed to the mind of the aspirant. As to the comprehension of the initiate, these words convey definite commands which only his illumined intuition can rightly interpret. With the higher grades of intelligences, we need not concern ourselves. We will consider this rule, therefore, solely from the angle of vision of the average aspirant, leaving other interpretations to those individuals who have the internal equipment which will enable them to understand. 1. ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. All forms in nature, as we well know, are made up of myriads of tiny lives holding a certain measure of awareness, of rhythm, and of coherency according to the force of the law of attraction utilized by the builder of the form. This is true both of the macrocosm and of the infinite world of microcosmic lives which are contained within the greater whole. Embryo solar systems coming into being under the impulse of divine thought are at first fluidic and nebulous, are shifting in outline, and are held together loosely by the central nucleus of energy, another way of expressing the embodied idea. As time progresses, they pass on to other conditions, they take more definite form, they enter into peculiar relations with allied and neighboring forms, and adjust themselves to varying relations of an internal nature with those forms, which in the earlier stage was not possible. Eventually, we find a solar system such as ours and myriads of others, a solar system functioning as a sun with its revolving and rotating planets, preserving their differing orbits, holding their stated and relative positions, active as independent and interdependent organisms, and yet presenting to the eye of the astronomer a coherence, a unity, and a structure that is unique in each case, and yet which functions under cosmic law. It measures up to some vast purpose conceived and held steadily in the universal mind, which is in its turn an aspect of that group conscious and self-conscious entity who is the author of its being and the creator of its form. This one intelligent life may be posited as creating in his meditation, or its, if you prefer, for what do words matter when all is futile to express reality as it is, and consequently in his reflective mind, that which we call a thought form. This thought form has four main characteristics. First, it is brought into being through the conscious use of the law of attraction. Second, it is formed of an infinite number of living entities who are attracted by the mind of the divine creator and thus enter into relation with each other. Third, the form is the externalization of something that its creator has A. visualized, B. built intelligently and colored or qualified so as to meet the purpose for which it was intended, C. vitalized by the potency of his desire and the strength of his living thought, D. held in shape as long as it is needed in order to perform its specific work, E. connected to himself by a magnetic thread, the thread of his living purpose and the strength of his dominant will. Fourth, this interior purpose, which has clothed itself in mental, astral, and vital substance, is potent on the physical plane just as long as A. it remains consciously in its creator's thought, B. it keeps its distance, occultly, from its creator. Many thought forms remain futile as they are too close to their creator. C. it can be directed in any desired direction and under the law of least resistance can find its own place, thus performing its desired function and carrying out the purpose for which it was created. The formula, therefore, might be regarded as the idea emanating from the divine thinker. It might be defined as the dynamic purpose, the thing as the thinker sees it and externalizes it in his mind and visualizes it as the carrier of his intent. The mathematics which underlie the construction of a bridge, such as any of the great spans which signalize human achievement, convey naught to the uninitiated, but to those who know and understand, they are the bridge itself reduced to its essential terms. They are the bridge in latency, and in these mathematical formulas lie hid the purpose, the quality, and the form of the completed structure and its eventual usefulness. So it is with the concepts and the ideas which give birth to a thought form. These occult formulas exist on the archetypal plane, which, for the aspirant, is the plane of the intuition, though in reality it is a state of consciousness far higher still. These formulas underlie a world of forms and must be contacted by those who are duly equipped to work under the great architect of the universe. There are, symbolically speaking, three great books of formulas. Note the words symbolically speaking and forget them not. There is first the Book of Life, read and eventually mastered by initiates of all degrees. There is the Book of Divine Wisdom, read by aspirants of all degrees, sometimes called the Book of Knowing Experience, and there is the Book of Forms, which is compulsory reading for all in whom the intelligence is awakening to functioning activity. It is with the Book of Forms that we are now concerned. Patanjali speaks in one place of the rain cloud of knowable things, of which the soul is consciously aware. The aspirant, weary of the eternal round of his own futile and unimportant thoughts, seeks to tap the resources of this rain cloud and so precipitate upon the earth some of the thoughts of God. He seeks to work so that he can further the manifestation of the ideas of the Creator. To do this, he has to fulfill certain initial requirements, which might be briefly stated as follows. 1. Know the true meaning of meditation. 2. Align with facility the soul, the mind, and the brain. 3. Contemplate or function as the soul on its own plane. It then becomes possible for the soul to act as the intermediary between the plane of divine ideas and the mental plane. You see how this matter of participation in the divine creative process works out as the objective of all true meditation work? 4. Register the idea received by the soul intuitively and recognize the form which it should take. These last 7 words are of vital importance. 5. Reduce the vague and misty idea to its essentials, discarding all vain imaginings and the formulations of the lower mind, so equipping oneself to leap readily into activity and, through steadfastness in contemplation, receive accurately the vision of the inner structure or of the subjective skeleton, if I may so term it, of the form which is to be. 6. This, as recorded consciously by the soul upon the mind, is as consciously registered by the mind, held steady in the light, and might be regarded as the reduction of the formula to the blueprint. It is not the formula itself, but the secondary process. According to the strength, the simplicity, and the clarity of the embodiment of the formula in a simple outline structure, so will be the finally furnished building and the consequent form, which will confine within the periphery of the outer form itself the lives used in its construction. This, in reality, resembles the stage of conception. Latent within the germ, the result of male-female interrelation, lie all the potencies and capacities of the finished product. Latent within the idea which has been materially conceived, but which has been inspired by the spirit aspect, lie hid the potencies of the finished thought forms. The matter aspect, represented by the mind, has been fecundated by the spirit aspect, and the triplicity will eventually be completed by the created form. But in the early stages, there is as yet only the formula, the conceived idea, the latent yet dynamic concept. It is potent enough to draw to itself the essentials for growth and form. Yet who shall say whether it will prove an abortion, a mediocre and feeble product, or a creation of real beauty and value? Every externalized idea is, therefore, possessed of form, animated by desire, and created by the power of the mind. The desire plane is the one upon which the mind imposes its conceptions in order to produce the idea incarnate, to clothe the idea in form. It is therefore the gestation ground. The mind previously has been the recipient of the archetypal idea as grasped and visualized by the soul. In its turn, the soul is the recipient of the formula as presented to it in the world of ideas. You have thus the presented idea, the perceived idea, and the formulated idea, and the idea working out into manifestation. It is well to bear in mind that the following factors govern the emergence of the idea out of the universal mind into the world of tangible forms. These are, 1. The energies emanating from the archetypal plane. This plane is the focus of the attention of the highest group of intelligences on our planet. Their consciousness can respond and be inclusive to this sphere of activity whereon the mind of God expresses itself, free from the limitations of what we understand as form. They are the custodians of the formula. They are the mathematicians who prepare the blueprints of the great plan. They calculate the effects of the forces with which the work is carried forward and the energies which must be manipulated. They allow for the strains and stresses to which the forms must be subjected under the impact of the life force. They deal with the cyclic impulses to which the evolutionary process must respond. They concern themselves with the relation between the form aspect and the life urge. 2. The intuitional state of awareness. On this level of consciousness, we find the masters of the wisdom carrying on their work, and it is in this sphere of influence that they work with the greatest ease and facility, as much so as does normally intelligent man work on the physical plane. Their minds are constantly in touch with the archetypal minds who are the custodians of the formulas, and they, taking the blueprints, I speak again in symbolic fashion, deal with the specifications, look for those suitable for the control of the work, and assemble the needed personnel. Among their disciples, they search until they find the one most suited to be the focal point of information on the physical plane, or the group most eligible to carry into manifestation the desired part of the plan. They work with those so chosen, impressing upon their minds that eternal triplicity of idea, quality, form, until the details begin to emerge and the work of what is literally a precipitation can go forward. 3. The activity of the mental state of consciousness. It is on the mental plane that much of this work is necessarily done, and here is reason sufficient for the development on the part of the aspirant of a trained intellect. The rain cloud of knowable things precipitates first of all on the mental plane, and a further precipitation goes forward when disciples and aspirants are the recipients. These latter, in their turn, seek to impress and guide the lesser workers and aspirants who, karmically or by choice, lie within their radius of influence. Thus, the idea presented is seized upon by many minds, and the formula aspect of the great work has played its part. It will be seen how this work is consequently and essentially group work, and is therefore only truly possible for those who have somewhat mastered the meditation process and can hold the mind steady in the light. This light, in reality, streams forth from the universal mind and is of varying kinds, and was, esoterically speaking, generated in a previous solar system and must be used and developed in this one. In the words, the light of the intuition, we have conveyed to our minds that type of energy which embodies the purpose, the will of God, the plan as we regard it. In the words, the light of the soul, we have an expression which sums up the purpose, the plan, the will of those entities who, incarnated in human form and at times functioning out of the body, have the responsibility of materializing the divine concepts in the four kingdoms in nature. The human kingdom is, par excellence, the medium of expression for the universal mind, and when the sons of God in human form are perfected, the problems of the natural world will be solved in a large measure. The fully conscious sons of God, aware of themselves whilst in the human form, and they are few as yet, constitute literally the brain of the planetary life. There is a truly occult significance to the words, to throw the light upon a problem, a condition, or a situation. In its essential meaning, it connotes the revelation of the presented idea, of the principle which underlies the outer manifestation. It is the recognition of the inner and spiritual reality which produces the outer and visible form. This is the keynote of all work in symbolism. The work of ascertaining the formulas, of drawing up the subjective charts or plans of intuitive impression and of intense activity on the mental plane, is the sole work of the organized planetary hierarchy. The second phase of the work is carried on by those workers who, cooperating consciously with the hierarchy, demonstrate the reality of that work in the three worlds of human evolution. They bring the germ of the idea and the embryonic concept into outer and completed existence through the process of right thought, the awakening of desire, and the nurturing of right public opinion. They thus bring about the needed physical activity. Aspirants, group leaders, and thinkers in all parts of the globe can be available for this work provided their minds are open and focused. According to the simplicity of their approach to truth, according to the clarity of their thought, according to their group influence and state of inclusive awareness, and according also to their power for long sustained effort, will be the approximation of the outer form to the inner idea and the spiritual subjective reality. The point I seek to make is that the average reader of these instructions has nothing to do with the formulas. They are grasped and understood by the great knowers who stand back of the evolutionary process and are responsible for its functional activity. The hierarchy of masters, of the senior initiates and disciples, is proceeding steadily with that work, but is dependent under the law upon those on the physical plane who are to produce the outer forms. If they fail to respond, there will be delay or incorrect building. If they make mistakes, there will be lost time and energy, and again, delay. If they lose interest and cease to work, or are primarily interested in their own affairs and personalities, the plan will have to wait, and energy which would otherwise be made available for the solving of human problems and the guidance of humanity will have to find its outlet in other directions. There is never anything static in the creative process. Energy which is flowing forth in the pulsation of the one life and its rhythmic and cyclic activity, never ending and never resting, must be somewhere utilized and must find its way in some direction, often, when man fails in his duty, with catastrophic results. The problem of cataclysms, the cause, for instance, of the steadily increasing insect peril, will be found to be related to the inflow of unused and unrecognized energy which is capable of right direction and right purpose and for the furthering of the plan, if the aspirants and disciples of the world will shoulder their group responsibilities, submerge their personalities, and achieve true realization. Humanity must be more diligent and more intelligent in the working out of its true destiny and karmic obligations. When men are universally en rapport with the custodians of the plan, and their minds and brains are illumined by the light of the intuition, of the soul, and of the universal mind, when they can train themselves to respond intelligently to the timely impulses which cyclically emanate from the inner side of life, then there will be a steady adjustment between life and form, and a rapid amelioration of world conditions. It is an interesting point to bear in mind that the first effect of the response of the more advanced of the sons of men to the formulas as translated and transmitted by the knowers will be the establishing of right relations between the four kingdoms in nature and right relations between units and groups in the human family. A step in this direction is being made. Relations between the four spheres of activity, which we call human, animal, vegetable, and mineral, are now badly adjusted because the energy of matter is primarily the governing factor. In the human kingdom, the working of this energy demonstrates in what we call selfishness. In the animal kingdom, it demonstrates in what we call cruelty, though where the sense of responsibility is non-existent and only instinctual and temporary parental responsibility is found, there is no criticism to be given. In the vegetable kingdom, this maladjustment expresses itself during this planetary period of misuse as disease. This surprises you? Disease has its roots primarily in maladjustments and misdirected force in the vegetable kingdom. This affects the animal and mineral kingdoms, and subsequently the human. It is too far ahead for this to be demonstrated, but when this condition is understood, it will be in that kingdom in nature that the attention of the investigators must be focused, and the eradication of disease will eventually find its solution. 2. Pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. Let us remember in connection with this rule that it is only potent insofar as the worker with the law is en rapport with the inner reality within himself, with the soul. It is essential that through him, in full waking consciousness, the soul should be functioning. It is the soul who pronounces the words. It is the soul who utters forth the mystic phrase. But it is the soul as controller or ruler of the mechanism, of the form apparatus. This control is only possible where there is alignment of the brain and mind and soul. Again, it is necessary to remember that this rule, being an expression of the creative work, applies to all creative process, whether macrocosmic or microcosmic, whether we are dealing with God as the creator of the solar system, with the soul as the creator of the human mechanism, or with the man as he attempts to master the technique of the magical work and so become a creator of forms in his own little sphere. All have to work out the true significance of the rule, for God works under the law of his being, and this law demonstrates to us as the laws of nature. The ideas of ordered activity and of a conscious and purposeful goal are bound up in the phrase we are considering. The builder of any form is first of all a controller of lives and the arbiter of the destinies of certain entities. In this thought, we have light thrown upon the subject of free will and upon the law of cause and effect. It must not be forgotten, however, that the mystery of causes lies hid in past universes, all in their day the forms indwelt by God. For us, there can be no such thing as pure cause, but only the working out of major effects. Just as for us, such a reality as pure reason is totally incomprehensible and unattainable, so with pure cause. These factors antedate our solar system, and therefore speculation about them remains unrewarded, except insofar as it tends to develop the mental apparatus. This solar system is a system of effects, which, in their turn, generate causes. Only in the human family, and only among those human beings who are consciously using mind power, are any causes of any kind being generated. All causes, being initiated by a mind of some kind, functioning consciously and thinking clearly, posit a thinker, and this is profoundly the position of the occult sciences. Our solar system is a thought form, but one having real existence just as long as thought persists. All that is forms part of the current of ideas emanating from the divine thinker. All thoughts are part of a divine stream. The mass of people think not, and so do not generate causes that must in due time produce their effect. You ask, where then the truth of the statement made in many occult modern books that the trend of life or cycle of lives indicates necessarily the future, and that the causes initiated in one life work out as effects in another? Where lives are predominantly emotional and are physically oriented, it is not a particular life that sets the pace, but the group of lives, simultaneously interacting with each other, predisposes the future along certain lines. This is eternally true of all human beings at a certain level of conscious development, where they are swayed by mass ideas, molded unthinkingly by tradition and public opinion, are frankly immersed in selfish interests, and are not taking hold of conditions themselves, but are being carried forward on the tide of evolution. It is a form of group activity, groups governed by the vibration of physical and astral forms, which produces the characteristics and tendencies which cause the situation and environing circumstances. In this realization lies hid the secret of racial and national karma and conditions. In these groups, the ordinary feeling, active man is immersed, and out of this immersion he must find his way by discovering and using his mind. Instinct must give place to intellect. For cycles of lives, groups of souls incarnate through the pull of the material forms towards which they are attracted. These attractive energies have earlier been utilized by the soul, finally being discarded and disintegrated. It is the potency of form which in the first case draws the soul into incarnation, for in the first half of the evolutionary process, matter, highly organized in a previous solar system, is the dominant factor. Later, we know spirit mounts on the shoulder of matter. The mass interplay of spirit and matter is now so potent that one of the major experiences that a soul undergoes is the achieving of the stage wherein the pull of matter begins to wane and the soul learns to detach itself. This is the experience through which humanity is now passing, again a group activity on a higher turn of the spiral. Large generalizations are indeed safer than the detailed and oft erroneous information anent the rules governing the taking and relinquishing of form found in much of our puerile literature, but even these generalizations should be regarded with much distrust. All that can be posited is that, under the law of cause and effect, spirit and matter coalesced and the worlds were made. Governed by the same law, forms were created and became material expressions of the life urge. They were swept in and out of manifestation according to a rhythmic cyclic beat initiated in still earlier solar systems than the one immediately preceding ours. Groups of forms appeared and disappeared and were governed almost entirely by their group coherence and vibration. So the life progressed through the elemental or involutionary kingdoms, through the three lower kingdoms in nature, and on into the human kingdom. In the lower human stages, and in the stage of animal man, the same group activity reigns, only, as in the involutionary kingdoms, becoming smaller and smaller groups as the individual units achieve, one by one, the status of truly self-conscious individuals and begin to work as souls. Then they not only become creators with the power of standing alone, with the faculty of clear thinking and accurate visualization, but demonstrate also that they are the possessors of the creative art or faculty of creative imagination. They pass through life after life of self-sufficiency in which the personality is developed and used. Then they begin to find their subjective group, which will eventually take the place of the outer material groups in their consciousness. Thus they regain again group existence, only this time in full awareness and control. In the group with which they find themselves subjectively affiliated will be found those who have worked with them in the earlier mass stage, so that they work in close association with those who have been nearest to them and who have been linked with them in the great life cycle. There are certain names given to these stages in the occult archives which are suggestive and illuminative. They are, of course, symbolic. It might be of interest if I gave some of these ancient cryptic utterances which convey three items of information, namely the name of the stage, its esoteric color, and its symbol. I would like to point out, however, that these intriguing pieces of information which I at times convey, and which some of the students seem to regard as of vital importance, are of far less importance than the injunction to live kindly, speak words of gentleness and of wisdom, and practice self-forgetfulness. The occult data is read and noted. The familiar instructions are skipped and overlooked. We who work with aspirants smile oft at the foolishness and lack of judgment evinced by those we teach. Say to a student, practice with steadfastness the law of loving kindness, and he will say, that indeed he will attempt to do. But within himself, the very familiarity of the injunction palls and is deemed at best a needed platitude. Say to the student, I will give you some occult phrases or some items of information anent the great ones, and with keenness, with excitement, and with smug self-satisfaction, and with a pleased curiosity, he prepares for the important revelation. Yet the earlier injunction is the conveyor of occult information and indicates a law which, if rightly followed, leads to release and liberation. The latter concerns phenomena, and the knowledge of it leads not the weary pilgrim to the gates of heaven. Some of you need this reminder. Those stages which precede the human are omitted, as none who will read these words possess the equipment to comprehend their inner sense. We will begin, therefore, with the stages in the human kingdom. Stage 1. The life has climbed the stairway long through daily use of form. Through the lesser three, with progress slow, the long path has been traveled. Another door stands open now. The words sound forth, enter upon the way of real desire. The life that only knows itself as form enshrouds itself in vivid red, the red of known desire, and through the red all longed-for forms approach, are grasped and held, used and discarded, until the red changes to rose, and rose to palest pink, and pink to white. Forth flowers, then, the pure white rose of life. The tiny rose of living life is seen in bud, not yet the full-blown flower. Stage 2. The picture changes form. Another voice, coming from close at hand, utters another phrase. The life continues on its way. Enter the field where children play and join their game. Awakened to the game of life, the soul passes the gate. The field is green, and on its broad expanse the many forms of the one moving life disport themselves. They weave the dance of life, the many patterned forms God takes. The soul enters the playground of the Lord, and plays thereon until he sees the star with five bright points, and says, "My star." The star is but a point of light, not yet a radiant sun. Stage 3. The way of red desire fails. It loses its allure. The playground of the sons of God no longer holds appeal. The voice which has twice sounded from out the world of form sounds now within the heart. The challenge comes, prove thine own worth. Take to thyself the orange ball of thy one-pointed purpose. Responsive to the sounded word, the living soul, immersed in form, emerges from the many forms and hews its onward way. The way of the destroyer comes, the builder, and again the tearer down of forms. The broken forms hold not the power to satisfy. The soul's own form is now the great desire, and thus there comes the entering of the playground of the mind. But in these dreams and fantasies, at times a vision comes, a vision of a folded lotus flower, close-petaled, tightly sealed, lacking aroma yet, but bathed in cold blue light. Orange and blue, in some more distant time, will blended be, but far off yet the date. Their blending bathes the bud in light and causes future opening. Let the light shine. Stage 4. Into the dark the life proceeds. A different voice seems to sound forth. Enter the cave and find your own. Walk in the dark and on your head carry a lighted lamp. The cave is dark and lonely. Cold is it, and a place of many sounds and voices. The voice of the many sons of God, left playing on the playground of the Lord, make their appeal for light. The cave is long and narrow. The air is full of fog. The sound of running water meets the rushing sound of wind and frequent roll of thunder. Far off, dim and most vaguely seen, appears an oval opening, its color blue. Stretched athwart this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen, and at the center of the cross, where four arms meet, a rose. Upon the upper limb, a vibrant diamond shines within a star, five-pointed. The living soul drives forward towards the cross which bars his way to life, revealed and known. Not yet the cross is mounted, and therefore left behind. But onward goes the living soul, eyes fixed upon the cross, ears open to the wailing cries of all his brother souls. Stage 5. Out into radiant life and light. The cave is left behind, the cross is overturned, the way stands clear. The word sounds clear within the head and not within the heart. Enter again the playground of the Lord, and this time lead the games. The way upon the second tier of stairs stands barred, this by the soul's own act. No longer red desire governs all the life, but now the clear blue flame burns strong. Upon the bottom step of the barred way, he turns back and passes down the stairs onto the playground, meeting dead shells built in an earlier stage, stepping upon forms discarded and destroyed, and holding forth the hands of helpfulness. Upon his shoulder sits the bird of peace, upon his feet the sandals of the messenger. Not yet the utter glory of the radiant life, not yet the entering into everlasting peace, but still the work and still the lifting of the little ones. Here, in symbolic form, we have pictures of human life and progress, of life in form and growing through the building process which marks the creative work. It is only a bald translation of some mantric phrases and of some basic symbols, and must in no way be considered to be anything except indicative of a process, veiled and couched, so that only those who know can understand. Esotericists will understand that these five stages cover the life period of every form, no matter whether the creator is cosmic, planetary, or human. Every form is built by an impulsive spark of life emanated by a creator and growing stage by stage under the law of accretion, an aspect of the law of attraction, which is the law of life. This law cooperates with the law of cause and effect, which, as we know, is the law governing matter. Cause, attraction or desire, accretion and effect, these four words govern the construction of any thought form. When the latter is a completed entity, it is an effect built by accretion under the power of an organized cause. The race has evolved now to a point where we think of effects primarily in terms of quality rather than in terms of matter. A thought form exists for us in order to produce an effect. The raison d'être of all forms we have come to feel is to express some subjective quality which will give us the key to its creator's purpose. Ponder on these words. Hence we find in this Rule 11 that the purpose of the word pronounced is to tell the lives which constitute the form what to do and where to carry that which has been made. Thus we find the idea of purpose, activity, and goal.